Father, bless these words to our hearts in Jesus' name. Today we're going to continue in our series on creation and evolution. And again, for anyone listening on the internet, if you're interested, all of this stuff is found in that book, Why We Believe in Creationism. You can find it online on Amazon. The Word of God says that everything in Genesis chapter 1 was created after its own kind. And we already mentioned that this is a genetic phenomenon. Everything is indeed created after its own kind. Evolution would necessarily require something to occur that was not the same as the kind of its parents. That would be a violation of one of the biggest rules of biology, which agrees with the Bible on this, that everything reproduces after its own kind. Everything reproduces after its own kind. Now, the notion in evolution is that things have changed and that there were countless intermediate forms. And they call those the missing links. Now, the reason why they are called the missing links is because they are missing. We cannot find them. We search the fossil record, and there is no hint of them. There are no missing links. But we know that there should be many, many, countless missing links. So scientists sometimes try to come up with explanations and reasoning and all this stuff, and sometimes they invent missing links, and they still have trouble with them because ultimately people show they are fraudulent. So today, for a few minutes, we're going to talk about the missing links, which are missing. Now, one of the biggest problems evolutionary theory has is the fossil record. Darwin understood this. As a matter of fact, his brother Erasmus wrote to him one time, "If you cannot support this with the fossil record and the facts, well, so much the worse for the facts." Well, that's not good reasoning. This is also one of the reasons, I believe, why the vanguard of evolution, when it first came out, were not scientists, but were lawyers and journalists and that type of person. But there were very few scientists among them. The theory had very little scientific acceptance for a long time. But eventually it did become a popular theory. So, scientists have to contend with the lack of evolution in evolutionary theory. Why are we not evolving now? And this is a problem. And so they came up with these two side theories to explain the problems with the big theory and why there is such a lack of evolution if everything evolved. Last time we mentioned that if evolution took place, then it had to take place within 10 to the 17 seconds, which is several billion years. In fact, as we mentioned, in the American Biology Teacher, it's a journal, in 1982, a biostatistician said it would require, if I remember correctly, the number was 1 times 10 to the 600 mutations to go from some inorganic molecules to evolve the average strand of DNA, not particularly complex, not particularly simple, the average strand of DNA. And that, of course, would put us to 1 times 10 to the 583 mutations per second. You'd be seeing that many mutations every second since evolution would have started, which we're giving them the 4.5 billion years they're claiming for the Earth. That's how many mutations it would take. So, I don't know about people other than myself, but I've never seen mutants that I'm aware of. And I've never seen populations evolving in front of my eyes, which you should be able to see, if that's in fact what took place. Now, scientists know that that problem is a overwhelming problem for the theory. And so there were two other theories that were brought up to explain this. One of those theories is called punctuated equilibrium. The other one is called evolutionary crystallization. Punctuated equilibrium says that evolution took place in spurts. In other words, you had relatively calm periods where very little mutation, very little population change was taking place. And then you had some sort of a drastic environmental event that triggered very rapid evolution taking place. And so they said things would be calm evolutionarily, and then they would be chaotic evolutionary with huge changes taking short periods of time. And then things would settle down again, and then things would get kind of crazy again, and more huge changes over short periods of time. Now, their short periods of time are not like 30 days. Their short period of time is like 30 million years instead of 300 million years. And so their short periods of time still aren't really short. Now, they never do contend with the time issues, and those are major issues, but that's not today's topic. We should still, over millions of years, even over thousands of years, we should still be able to see evolutionarily transition forms. But we don't see them. We have a very strong grasp on what's on the geologic column, and we know what is and what is not there. And the transitional forms simply don't exist. We do find strange things in strange places, like in Nautiloid Canyon, in the Grand Canyon. Marine animals, saltwater creatures living in the middle of a canyon with a freshwater river running through it. So even if, which it was not, but even if the Colorado River created the Grand Canyon, which we know very well that could not have taken place because that's not the way things work. But even if that were the case, where did the saltwater creatures come from? Well, the fact that there's fossils anyway indicates a great deal. Now, the geologic column is pretty much the same all over the world. We know that. We can see it. Scientists have studied the geologic column extensively. And it's pretty much the same all over the world. Now, not every place in the world has all the layers of the column. However, what's present in the various layers is pretty much the same all over the world. Now, the column and all fossils seem to appear and start there in the Cambrian explosion. Cambrian explosion is a layer where all these fossils all of a sudden can be found. Below that layer, you find virtually nothing. But in the Cambrian explosion, you have this layer where you found all these various fossils of all these various species, many more species than we have around today. And that is one fossil-rich area. And it tells us something about that. The Cambrian explosion can be found everywhere on the planet. And it is also the great evidence of Noah's flood. The Cambrian explosion is Noah's flood. This is how it works. When an organism dies, it has to be covered very rapidly with sediment in order to fossilize. If it's not covered rapidly, you will get no fossil. Either you'll have decomposition or scavengers will pick apart the carcass, but you will not get a fossil. However, if that organism, whether it's a leaf or a dog or what have you, is covered by sediment very quickly and it's protected and it will fossilize. Anywhere where you have a fossil, you have rapid deposition of sediment. There are only two known events that will deposit sediment that quickly: a volcanic eruption or a flood. Those two things will deposit sediment fast enough so that something can fossilize. Now, we do know that there are a great many volcanoes and a great many volcanic eruptions. However, the Cambrian explosion, everything around the world, pretty much at the same time, became fossilized. Now, we have to understand that fossils are not the appearance of organisms. They're the death of organisms. So what the Cambrian explosion is telling us with the sudden dramatic appearance of fossils is that a very large number of all types of species died very quickly all over the world and were buried in sediment very quickly all over the world. There is no history of global volcanic eruptions taking place uniformly around the world. We do have history of a global flood taking place uniformly all over the world. The evidence for the flood is overwhelming. I'm not going to get into the flood evidence right now. That's not my point today. But I can tell you that the way that some of these fossils are deposited, like trees, for example, where they're inverted and diagonal, tells us that these trees were caught up in a flood, deposited, and covered very fast. Now, when Mount St. Helens erupted, the volcano in Washington State, in 1980, it formed a lake underneath. And it formed something of a small canyon underneath. That volcanic eruption lasted around roughly a day. It was not a long volcanic eruption, at least the part where the spewing of things was taking place. Volcanic eruptions come with flooding because the pressure that's beneath the surface and all the heat and the magma and stuff, the pressure that's building up to cause the volcanic eruption also causes water to come out of fissures in the sides of the mountain. That water comes out quite drastically, quite rapidly, with a great deal of force, and it can carve out formations in the ground. In this case, it carved out what is described as a 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon. Those people who are creationists and geologists will tell you that the Grand Canyon was formed in the flood. That the Coriolis force, which is caused by the churning of the earth, with that much water would have been so profound that the water would have been essentially like a saw. And it would have carved away, this water would have carved away the ground very quickly and very effectively. As a matter of fact, they believe that the water level around places like the Grand Canyon was actually very low. While the global water level you can calculate was approximately 5 miles deep, the water level around places where the Coriolis forces were, they're similar. You could almost say they were kind of like the water version of a jet stream in the air, where they're like these rivers within the water that are moving very rapidly, and some scientists believe they were only a few inches deep. But in order for that to be only a few inches deep, the pressure has to be immense. That force with which that water is traveling across the rock has got to be immense. And it's very easy, if you research this, to see how the Grand Canyon could have been carved out really only in a matter of days, if not hours. You could have had this massive structure carved out. Things like the Colorado don't have the capacity to carve out a canyon like the Grand Canyon. And a lot of geologists have a great deal of trouble, even if they can't come up with an alternate explanation of accepting the river carving out the Grand Canyon. Plus the fact that it's a freshwater river with saltwater marine creatures stuck about 300 feet high into the walls of the canyon. Anyway, the lack of the fossil record is a problem. Fossils are formed when they are covered quickly with sediment. So they came up with this notion of punctuated equilibrium. Well, these things died very fast, only for short periods of time, and then nothing happened. And then short periods of time, again, evolution took place and nothing happened. But we still don't see any transitional forms. Whether it happened quickly or whether it happened slowly, we should be seeing transitional forms that represent what the theory is claiming. So we should be seeing, if punctuated equilibrium were correct, areas within the fossil record where you have very few transitional forms or no transitional forms, simply a few scattered fossils here and there. And then areas where you have a tremendous number of fossils, especially transitional forms, followed by an area where you have very little, followed by areas where you have much, and so on. But the fossil record doesn't support that at all. As a matter of fact, there is literally no evidence at all for punctuated equilibrium except the lack of evolution, which in and of itself is not the evidence for the theory that is trying to explain the phenomenon. The fossil record is a huge problem. So other people have come up with the notion of evolutionary crystallization. Evolutionary crystallization says that as organisms evolve, they're going up what you could call a fitness mountain range. In other words, they're becoming more and more adapted for their environment. And when they reach maximum levels of adaptation, they are at the peak of their adaptation ability dictated by the environment. So they're completely adapted for the environment. And that motion toward that peak adaptation is something of a mountain that evolution climbs with the organisms. And then when it gets to the peak, it's fully adapted. And if you change something about the environment in which the organism finds itself, perhaps the organism migrates, or the environment itself changes, then you essentially put it on a new mountain. So you have a new mountain to climb so it can evolve more until it reaches the peak once again. And then you would need to put it on a new mountain again to get it to evolve more. The trouble again is there is absolutely zero evidence to support the theory. It's just an idea, nothing more. Punctuated equilibrium, just an idea, nothing more. But because it's an idea that explains the problem, and because nobody else is coming up with explanations, certain individuals in the scientific community latch onto these ideas and then they propagate them. The lack of evidence is often not a problem. There are some forms that have been called transitional forms in the fossil record. In most textbooks on this, you will see the evolution of the horse. And they usually show you three types of organisms, and they'll put them one on top of another with a little arrow there to show you how this little horse is progressing. And it does actually represent, although it's an artist's depiction, not an actual event or actual finding in the fossil record, but it does represent things they did find in the fossil record. And so they have this little horse, and it's becoming a bigger horse. And then one evolutionary anthropologist realized that the little horse is no horse but a rock badger. That they're calling the rock badger the precursor to the horse. The problem is, according to evolutionary theory, if something has evolved from another organism, the original organism must be gone. There had to be a transition that took place. And evolutionary theory necessarily requires that the new form is better suited in the environment than the old form, and therefore the new form replaces the old form. Well, when certain ones studied this, they found, no, these aren't primitive horses, they're rock badgers. And rock badgers are still around today. There was for a while the notion that small horses led to big horses. And then there was this big thing written up about how these small horses, about the size of a big dog, maybe like the size of a, I don't know, Great Dane or something like that, or maybe a Mastiff, became horses, like we know today, until they found some guy in Scotland breeding these small horses. And they said, well, that can't be right. There was another one that was used as an index fossil, Metmeria. It's a type of a fish. And the idea was that this fish became extinct 70 million years ago. And so, you could gauge the age of other fossils according to the fossils of this particular fish. Because the idea is, well, if it's dead 70 million years, then if something is found lower in the fossil record, it's older than 70 million years. And if it's found higher in the fossil record, it's younger than 70 million years. And so this was a well-known, highly used index fossil. Because everybody knew it was extinct, but they knew the fossil well. That is, of course, until some fishermen started catching these fish off of Madagascar. And they realized, no, they're not extinct at all. And so the whole notion that this fish could be used to predict the age of other fossils went out the window. These index fossils have their own share of problems. When evolutionists want to come up with a missing link, they have really very little to work with. If you ever go to a natural history museum, you'll probably see something like this. You'll see a skull, and they will tell you it's just the skull of a primitive whatever. Sometimes an artist will build a model. Please understand that when an artist builds a model, it is according to the artist's imagination. Nobody actually found somebody's head buried in the sand, and now they put it in a museum. It's something that was made by an artist who was paid to make something with a particular description. And so, when they get these skulls, these bones, often they get only small fragments. If you go to these natural museum histories, you'll be able to see what is original and what is clay. And the portions of the fossils that you see, the vast majority is clay, with only small portions being the original. And the rest of it is built around the fossil they did find, a small part, maybe a jawbone. Well, a jawbone is not going to give you a whole lot of information about the back of the skull. But they use this, then they make an assumption, and they build something around it. Well, it's not really great science, but that's how it's done. For example, when Louis Leakey and his wife Mavis were digging, and I'm not saying these are dishonest people, I'm sure they're very sincere people. The question is, are they getting it right? They took about a half a year to come up with a skull. And they would dig these little tiny pieces of bone that were often no bigger than your thumbnail. For months and months, they were finding pieces of bone, and they were putting the bone together to form a skull. These tiny little pieces. Well, I can take tiny little pieces of glass and form a skull. They're tiny, and I have glue. So the question isn't, are they sincere or honest? The question is, did they get it right? Nobody's questioning their sincerity. But did they get it right? And that is an important question, because very frequently, they don't get it right. Let me give you an example. In that book, there's a section called Creative Anthropology and the Making of a Missing Link. I think that's a pretty good section. Anthropology does get very creative. Some of it's more famous and better accepted than other things. Perhaps one of the most well accepted was Peking Man. There was a British university professor who was teaching at the medical school in Peking, China. And this was prior to World War II. And he went to a cave that wasn't too far outside of town. And in that cave, he says that he found a human femur. And then he also found a skull. And he put the femur together with the skull, declared it a missing link, and the skull was clearly ape-like, and the femur was clearly human. Now, unfortunately, the original bones mysteriously disappeared. So nobody could really examine them. But this was his report. However, people did go and examine the cave. And they did find human remains. And they did find ape remains. Now, they did find ape remains. And what they saw was once a cooking area. So people in China, we know, used to cook apes. And they would eat certain types of monkeys and things. And then about 60 meters, if I remember correctly, away, there was also a human burial area. And the doctor did say that he found these two remains about 60 meters apart, again, if I remember the distance correctly. So you have a very large missing link with a skull 60 meters away from the leg. But somehow he put these together, but the bones disappeared, so we couldn't really examine them. However, the missing link did become very famous as Peking Man. Another one of my favorites was Cambrian Man. Actually, my all-time favorite was Cambrian Man. Cambrian Man was found in England when missing links were all the rage. There was a time when missing links were all the rage in the early few decades of the 1900s. Everybody was finding them everywhere and everyone wanted the oldest one. And so, of course, the British wouldn't be left out. And so they came up with a missing link. They found in some dirt what they declared to be an ancient fossil. And they made a big to-do about it and wrote it up. And in the end, the ancient fossil turned out to be a cricket bat. You know, the sport cricket, like baseball? Yeah, it turned out to be a cricket bat. That was now a missing link. That one was discredited. Another one the British had, I'm not trying to pick on the British, they're wonderful people. Now, another one that the British had was Piltdown Man. And that was put together by a couple of scientists. And they stained some teeth and filed some things down on an ape to make it look more human, and then they declared it to be a missing link. That one also was discredited. Many of these were discredited. There was a guy in South Africa a few years ago who found these very ancient fossils that were preserved in remarkably good condition for something that old, which the condition of them itself raised a few eyebrows. But then other experts came in and said, no, this is simply another fossil that we found and people have known about for quite some time. It's not another missing link. My next personal favorite was Nebraska Man. The United States was not behind in the race for the fossil hunt. In a farm in Nebraska, a farmer found a tooth. Go figure. And he took it to the local college, and one of the professors at the college looked at it and declared it to be a missing link. Early form of human, and they called it Nebraska Man. This one lasted for a good 30 years. There was all kinds of stuff written about Nebraska Man. And they put the tooth in a museum. And then one day, a paleontologist happened to take a look at the tooth. And he told them, what you have here is a pig's tooth. So a farmer found a pig's tooth on a farm. That's very strange, isn't it? That a pig's tooth would be found on a farm. But they made a missing link out of it. There's another one I like where they found an ancient clavicle. There was a missing link until the paleontologist said this is a dolphin's rib. And so it wasn't a missing link, it was a dolphin. These are found all over the place. I like one in particular in Spain also. They found this ancient skull that they said was one of the early humans in Europe. And the Spanish, God bless them, they arranged an international symposium where all these scientists from all over the world were going to come and look at this ancient human that they found, new thing. And a week prior to the symposium, some French paleontologists got there early. and they told them what you have found was a donkey skull. And so there goes another missing link. So the problem with these missing links is that they're still missing. If you have people that are coming up with them left and right, I don't know why. I have to wonder if they're not trying to make a name for themselves. But I don't really know. But they're coming up with them left and right, and they just seem to get them wrong. Now, one of the most beautiful examples of a missing link was archaeocetes. Archaeocetes are ancient whales. Now, scientists have wondered about the evolution of whales. And in an ancient watering hole in Kenya, they found a number of land animal fossils. A lot of them looked like wolves. And they found these fossils near a watering hole. Well, that's kind of easy to understand. The way that fossils are made and the fact that animals often congregate around watering holes. And so they found a handful of fossils, and the fossil included a portion of a jaw with a tooth that looked like a land animal. They had an auditory ossicle, part of the ear, the mechanism, that looked like a land animal. They had a part of a hip that looked like a land animal. This was written up, by the way, in Science magazine. And they find all these portions that look like land animals. So you have a tooth and portion of the auditory mechanism and a hip. All of them look like a wolf-like land animal. And the scientists who were very much hoping to find an ancient whale in this Kenyan watering hole declared that this was an archaeocete. In other words, this was an ancient whale. Now, here's the problem. Number one, whales don't look like land animals. Now, if a whale had an auditory mechanism like a land-dwelling animal, it would be deaf. They have a one-piece auditory mechanism. Land-dwelling animals have a three-piece auditory mechanism. And that's necessarily so because of the way that sound travels through water and through air. If you have a land type of an auditory mechanism, it will be very difficult to hear in water. If you have a water-adapted auditory mechanism, it will be very difficult to hear on land. Now, in the water, it works well for one, and on the land, it works well for the other. Now, whales depend on their auditory mechanism to find food. They will starve if they cannot hear. And so, this somehow land-like auditory mechanism was supposed to give that whale some sort of an evolutionary advantage, even though it made it deaf and not able to eat. Now, the tooth was important because if you have a tooth like a wolf, then you are capable of eating things that a wolf eats, like flesh. But whales, for the most part, don't eat flesh. And so you have a mechanism for eating that was made for land, not for water, but this was somehow an evolutionary advantage. And then you had that portion of the hip. Well, if a whale has a land-like hip, like a wolf does, then it will not be able to effectively propel itself in the water. Likewise, if you put a whale on the land, it would not be able to propel itself on the land. But in the water, its hip works very effectively. And a wolf's hip works very effectively on the land. They're not interchangeable. So if they give an hip to a whale that is like that of a wolf, then you're going to have a lame whale. So now you have this deaf, whales are blind anyway, for the most part, blind, unable to eat, unable to chew, unable to propel whale, and they call it an evolutionary advantage. Nonsense. To me, if it looks like it belongs on a land animal and it works like it belongs on a land animal, it probably belongs to a land animal, since they found it among other fossils they know belong to land animals. But that's how evolutionary theory often works as far as the fossils go. Then you have people who come up with things like Australopithecus, which was Lucy. It had 40%, I believe it was, of a skeleton. And in the end, they found out that Lucy was just another ape. But they laid it down like it was some kind of a human, and they described it as a human. The interesting phenomenon with Australopithecus was that they seemed to find two different types. There was a larger type, and then there was a smaller type. And they were thinking, okay, what's the evolutionary relationship between these two types? And then one, I think, very smart anthropologist said to them, why do you think that there would only be one size Australopithecus? In humans, males are typically larger than females. In most mammals, males are typically larger than females. Why do you think that if there was an intermediate form called Australopithecus, that the male would not be larger than the female, which is standard for so many mammals? And so one of the problems they have is that the evolutionary types may very well reflect differences in gender rather than differences in species. Things like size are not reliable indicators evolutionarily. For example, you may have certain people, like in Nigeria, where people can be quite tall. And then you may have other people, like the pygmy populations, where people are quite short. And these people are found on the same continent. They're not different species. They're simply different bone structures. You have people with one set of physical characteristics living in Sweden and another set of physical characteristics living in Japan. They're not different species. They're simply different bone structures. Different colors. You have all kinds of differences, and they're built into our genetics. What we often think of as missing links simply are not missing links. The fact is that the missing links are called missing because they are in fact not present. We don't have them, and they're thought to be missing because they ought to be there. But on the other hand, if something is not supposed to be there, then you can't even call it missing. For that matter, you can't even call it a link. All right, that's it for today.